Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Hal Marley. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And as some of you may know, I try to practice an attitude of gratitude because I have a lot to be grateful for. I pray every morning that wonderful little prayer from the 24-hour book. I pray that I may be grateful for the things I have received and do not deserve. I pray that this gratitude will make me truly humble. And tonight I have another good example of why I'm grateful, the wonderful dividends this program has given me. So to be honest with you, back in my boozing days, I normally wouldn't have associated with a man who'd walked on the moon. I just didn't travel in those circles. But by the grace of God in AA, I've been a friend of brothers for a number of years, and we helped him celebrate, and I can continue. We co-celebrated his 5th anniversary, 5 years of continued sobriety in AA, so we'll continue that tonight. And it's a pleasure to introduce a man who needs no introduction. Buzz, come up.
Buzz Aldrin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm nervous, too. I don't do this all that often. And I just hope that somehow we can get a nice informal rapport going. And that's kind of up to me to do. I quit smoking 2 days ago, 3 days ago. But I also need to tell you that I quit smoking 4 years ago. This hasn't been the easiest endeavor in my life. I first came into treatment about 8.5 years ago. And I have had a variety of different recovery assistors and institutions, people, friends, wives. And one thing is crystal clear. I'm a far better man today than I was 8.5 years ago. And if there's anything that you carry away from our bearing witness to victory over our difficulties, it's that this program works. I grew up in New Jersey, a rather upper-class family. My father's Swedish, and my mother was sort of half Scotch and half Welsh. And believe it or not, my grandfather's name on my mother's side was Fay Arnold Moon. It was a well-to-do family. My father had been an early aviation pioneer. He learned to fly in 1917, and he was General Billy Mitchell's aide in the Philippines, where he met my mother, who was a daughter of an army chaplain over there. And my father went on in his Air Corps assignments to command the, or to be in charge of the engineering school at Wright Field. And he was a commandant there for about 4, 5, 6 years. And since he had a doctor's degree from MIT, he observed and instructed most of the leaders that eventually became the major generals or the leading generals during World War II. He went into the reserve in 1928 and went to work for Standard Oil Company. And shortly before I was born, they moved into a house, and he sold a lot of stock in 1929 and bought a house so that when the crash came in the market way, we came out of that situation pretty good. I had two older sisters, one of them about a year and a half older, and the other 3 years older than that. And until I made a legal change in my name this last week, my name was Edwin Eugene Aldrin, Jr. And everybody wonders where in the world Buzz came from. Well, the Air Corps people called my father Eddie. for the first name, Edwin. And my mother called him Gene for Eugene. So when I came along, there wasn't any really appropriate name. So they didn't want to call me Junior. So to my sisters, why, that creature crawling around the floor was Baby Brother. And she couldn't pronounce that, and it was Baby Buzzer, and that changed throughout the years. And it used to make me embarrassed to think about that story. And let's see, I was 24 years old, and at the Air Force Academy, when I finally got grounded for flying low over the beach in New Jersey, and finally was able to live up to that name. My family was involved in social situations that required them to, or at least I was exposed to the fact that highball was an item of social lubrication, or at least that seemed to be something that kept things going. And my father was a very hard-driving person, and there's little doubt that that influence on my life of wanting me to follow somewhat in his footsteps tended to mold my early life. I was put into kindergarten at the earliest age possible, 4 and a half, something like that. And even though I was really immature for first grade, they lobbied with the principal and kept me there. And that was great because when I got out of high school at just a little over 17, I was near the top of my class academically. But I didn't really fit in. I was very good in athletics. I was on the football team, on the first team, and a pole vaulter. I sure wouldn't want that to happen to my children. And the reason I'm giving you that background is because that plus an ethnic background of Scandinavian, plus a lot of environmental situations, I think, brought on the alcoholism that saw its maturity a bit later in life than perhaps many of you might have seen. My mother was a very depressive person. I can remember when we were children that they would have their drink at the dining room table. My grandmother was living with us at the time, and it was just constant bickering, and it just wasn't really what I would call a happy home environment. And my two older sisters got married, and they left, and I went to West Point. And I just don't think my mother enjoyed things. They moved from a house into an apartment. And she would associate with some of the New Jersey Shore ladies who would get together, and they'd have their drinking sessions. And that was her circle, and she didn't go socially where my father went. He'd go into New York and be in the Wings Club, or he'd go to Rotary. And that was the kind of environment that I grew up in, but I grew up as an achiever. An achiever who knew by the measure of my standing relative to those around me that somehow I'd had what it took in the particular test, however narrow it really was, but I really didn't deserve it because I didn't feel like I deserved it. And when I got to West Point young, I just didn't feel comfortable there. There were the older people and the people that socially got together, and there were some people who had a couple of years in the Army before. You know, the first Christmas that you're at West Point, at least it was that way then, you don't get to go home at Christmas. And of course, I lived in New Jersey, and it was just a short ways up the river. During part of that Christmas vacation, the plebes are there, and a few upperclassmen are staying there with them. And I can remember getting a Coca-Cola and putting some aspirin in it. Because, you know, things were just not that comfortable. And I don't think there was one smidgen of an effect that it ever had on me. But that's the frame of mind of what I mean, obviously I wasn't about to have someone bring in a bottle of whiskey. I wasn't that mature. And yet on graduation, of course, we're mature enough to command flights in combat. We're mature enough to command platoons. You know, a lot of times I look back on those days in my youth, and I just shiver to think how ill-prepared I really was. And a lot of it was in my mind. Frankly, a good bit of my life on up until glimpses of peace and comfort in the last, I got to say, about 4 or 5 years, maybe 2 years. That's pretty good last week, as a matter of fact. It really is getting better. 2 months ago, I was in the pit, so. I really don't think there were, when I was in high school, being on the high school football team and the track team, there were fraternities and sororities, and for the initiation, you know, people would do a big thing of pouring all sorts of jazz mustard and ketchup and this kind of sauce and that kind of onion stuff and a little bit of beer and a little bit of one kind of liqueur and another. Those were big things as a freshman. And New Year's Eve with friend 75, man, that was really, really bold. You know, I just don't think we grew up in the same era or the same times. And I know that that isn't true for people my own age that grew up. I may be flavoring things a little bit as I view the past as it being kind of an immature recollection. I graduated third in my class at West Point, and of course, with the background of my father being in the Air Corps, I wanted all my life to get into airplanes to fly. I had my first flight. I vaguely remember this by people telling me, and then my visualizing thing. I really think I can remember a flight when I was about a year and a half or 2 years old. We flew down to Florida, and I got sick. And about a year or two later, I got a chance to, as a veteran now, to take off in an amphibian in Newark Bay when my sister had her first flight. And she got sick. And, you know, I felt pretty good about that. And incidentally, that plane was there's a picture in our basement where that plane was christened by Amelia Earhart. And General Mitchell, Billy Mitchell, came to our place in New Jersey on his way to New York in the early 30s, associated with his court-martial appearances. And Jimmy Doolittle has been a friend of my folks for a good long while. So you see, I grew up with a certain amount of achievement, a certain amount of associating with the achievers, with the winners. And that sort of thing was expected of me. Well, I certainly expected of myself, and on the record, it certainly looked as if I was doing that. After going through pilot training, I went over to, my first assignment was over to Korea. And obviously something had slowly been happening because somewhere between Camp Stoneman in California and Tokyo, where I visited some friends on my way to Korea, I had made a resolution that I wasn't going to drink. Now, not every second lieutenant makes that resolution. Obviously, that's not average reaction to the kind of childhood I'm talking about. There was something that was going on there, and it was an insecurity. It was a feeling ill at ease, not deserving the sort of things that were coming my way. And obviously an awareness that alcohol, though it was making what I did a bit more comfortable at the time, because that's what the other people did and they seemed to enjoy it, and it did make things a little bit easier for me to do. But clearly at the mature age of 22, going over to fight in the Korean War, not drinking alcohol was important enough for me to make the resolution. And I got over there, and I saw some of my friends. The reason I didn't go over was actually with the same time as some of our flying classes, because I'd taken a slight delay competing for a Rhodes Scholarship. And don't you think the fighter pilots at the gunnery school at Nellis had a time kidding me about, you know, the commies were going to have me in their guns. I got a real scar. Well, that's okay. I didn't get that anyway, and I can rationalize my way around that. There were occasions, just carry it through. It didn't take 2 or 3 days for me to realize that there was no way that I was going to handle this situation with my friends over there and my not drinking while everybody was in the club drinking. So that resolution went by the board. Now, let me backtrack a little bit. And when I was competing for a congressional appointment to either West Point or Annapolis, this was my junior year in high school. I went to a prep school to try and teach us how to pass that exam that the people over there on the hill would give us. And it was a real general, well-rounded education, especially in vocabulary. We get the dictionary out, and we went from A's, and we learned the words, down through the M's by the time the course was over. So if we had vocabulary questions on the latter part, why, that was just the breaks. While I was there, it was a group of about 10 or 15 of us. And naturally, for a little excitement, we decided to skip out one night. And there were going to be 4 of us, and we got this janitor to get us a bottle of whiskey. You know, the trouble is he brought back gin. And instead of 4 of us getting out, there were only 2 of us, me and this other guy. And yeah, he was obviously a bit more savvy and aware, and I recognized this, but I was damned if he was going to drink any of my share of that. And I was a stumbling, blubbering, incoherent, puking 16-year-old example of American youth that night. And that stuck in my mind for quite a while. But it didn't stop me from drinking because, as I mentioned, several years later, I made the resolution not to drink at all. There were several occasions when I was in Korea when one in particular that I remember, it was on a training mission before we were qualified for combat, and something went a little wrong with the emergency fuel control, and I had to hold a switch in a spring-loaded position in order for the engine to operate normally. The fuel control had failed in a way that it was full on 100%, and the only way that you could get anything other than full power in this F-86 was to throw this switch. And, of course, that was the same hand that you had to push the mic button on. So the whole operation was really not what you'd call smooth. I was trying to maintain formation with a guy, and I kept climbing high, and I lost him. And it was just a bad scene, and I didn't feel good about it. And I was obviously a little hungover. And when I got on the ground, I wasn't going to drink anymore. And that lasted 3 or 4 days. And there's always a reason why, you know, that's not important anymore. I want you to get the impression I was a cream of American youth about this time. My military, well, I got married shortly after I came back from Korea at age 24. Slightly on the rebound from a turn down. That marriage eventually lasted 19, 20 years. And we were assigned to the Air Force Academy. I was aide to the Dean of Faculty. Again, you know, up on the pedestal. That was when I got caught for a buzz on the beach when a guy was walking his dog along the coast of New Jersey at 5:30 in the morning. No, nobody's supposed to do that. My God. That wasn't so bad, but the next day, Sunday morning, as I was leaving, why, I went up and down the beach, out over the shore, or over the ocean this time. Put the gear down, of course, so I could demonstrate to everybody that the airplane would fly slow. The same doctor had a pair of binoculars out, evidently. I had an efficiency report that was endorsed for the short period that I was there as they used the term self-effacing. And, you know, that made me feel bad. You know, I thought I was a forceful, aggressive person. Maybe a little on the shy side. I certainly wasn't the tiger, the life of the party of the captain who was the other general's aide. But that was a very accurate appraisal of my state at that time. I was very competent young officer. I was a good pilot, outstanding pilot in some ways. But I was self-effacing. That means I didn't project the best of me forward. There was always greater potential if you'd only do it right, you know. And I think there are a good number of us who have experienced living under maybe conditions similar to that. There's another breed of cat, and that's the very exuberant one, and he's the insecure one, who's maybe using the outward exuberance and joke-telling to maybe cover up some of the insecurity. We're all insecure, and we just manifest it in different ways. I'm not sure that it's particularly pertinent to all the lucky breaks that came my way after being a fighter pilot in Germany. This particular wing we were in was F-100s, and because I got to pick my assignment when I left the Air Force Academy in, 1956. I pretty much had to pick the cream of assignments, and this was the hottest airplane that we had in the Air Force at that time, and it was in Germany, and looked like a really good assignment. We were in day fighters, and we, about halfway through that tour, converted over to tactical weapons delivery, nuclear weapons. And that's a humbling experience, transitioning from where you hassle the guy in the air to when you're on a 5 or 10 minute a 15-minute alert, and if, you know, if that happens to be the day, why, you're on your way, and it's a lonely feeling to be shooting at low altitude, 360 knots, each tick on the map you have marked off, and it's not very sophisticated in those days. It was so many minutes you're supposed to go so far. But it was a very imposing mission. And yet, one of the first times I was on alert, I had one tremendous hangover. Now, most everyone else did the same sort of thing. It didn't show quite so much, perhaps. When I left that assignment, I went back to MIT and had decided that fast reactions and fighter pilot business was great, and you know, I felt I could do that, and was on the squadron gunnery team representing our squadron in NATO. But somehow I just didn't want to be destined to that for the rest of my career, so I wanted to, I guess, take the same route that my father had, so I went back to school to MIT. Because of drinking wine out of dirty wine glasses in Naples on the last vacation that we had over in Germany, I was in the hospital for hepatitis for about 9 months. It was really quite a case. Right at the beginning of my MIT, I was a captain just promoted to major. I was promoted to major a year or two after I was there. When you have that severe case of hepatitis, you're not supposed to drink, and people say, gee, maybe you have not a drink for the rest of your life. Not me. After, 5 or 6 months, I'd have a drink, and that appeared to be the right thing. I was at MIT a year and a half, and I decided to extend for another year and a half to work on a doctor's degree rather than go through... I was really following very closely the path of Ed White. He and I were at West Point together. He was a class behind me, and we were in the same fighter unit over in Germany. And after he came back about a year or so earlier than I did, and we corresponded, and he had applied for the, he said he was going to apply for the second group of astronauts, and he'd gone through the test pilot school. I had elected to put that off sometime into the future and to stay at MIT and work on a doctor's degree. And I went through a process of reasoning that, as I look back on it, it sounds very mature reasoning for somebody at that point, but I picked a course of study in manned orbital rendezvous. I wanted to use the experience that I had as a fighter pilot and the sophistication of Massachusetts Institute of Technology and inertial guidance and orbits and trajectories and do something that would be useful to the service or to NASA within 15 years. When I applied for that second selection group of astronauts, I wasn't qualified because I hadn't been through the test pilot school. But I had a rather envious record at that point that I'd accumulated at West Point, combat in Korea, shot down two MiGs over there, and you know, I was working on a doctor's degree at MIT in rather good physical shape, but I wasn't qualified. So Ed was picked in the second group along with eight other people. And that was in 1962, and they changed the rules in 1963, and you didn't need to be a graduate of test pilot school. They put a little bit more emphasis on education. So I was picked to get into our astronaut program in 1963. And I didn't feel like I belonged there either. Because I wasn't one of the boys. I wasn't one of the test pilots. I had other credentials, of course, that in many ways supplemented what I had lacked in experience. Those were rather productive years in as I look back on what I was able to do in terms of having a small influence from what I studied at MIT, having an influence on the directions and sort of the methods in which we carried out our program. And by this time, I had three children quite close together, 2 years about separated the first two and 10 months separated the second two. They were all, let's see. Well, right now they're 28, 26, and 25. So, that was like, 15, 16, 17 years ago. The influence of the space program on me was rather awesome. There are a lot of details that could explain why I happened to end up where I did, but a lot of it really was being in the right place at the right time. It was a productive period. I felt I contributed significantly. We played relatively hard. I don't look back on those years and say that there was much of a progression of alcoholism from the active participating standpoint. From the emotional build up to a crisis or crescendo, that was going on, and I didn't know that it was going on. I had my first flight in 1966 in November. And the impact of public appearances and, in a sense, the loss of direction being within my grasp and my influence, at first, that was the first I really began to see someone else telling me to go do something that I didn't feel comfortable doing. And I knew I had to do it in one fashion or another, and I did it. But looking back on it, I can remember some periods of rather immobilizing concern, anxiety, and fear. Obviously, not looking good, of not doing what I thought I ought to be able to, and not living up to their expectations. After Apollo, this came in spades. Really. The carrying out of the mission itself was unencumbered. It was just a beautiful experience to be a part of. But there was always that uneasiness about what this was going to mean to my life afterwards. And I began to feel the effects of this immediately on return in terms of the concern for looking good. I was under medication for antidepressants when we were on our around-the-world trip. And I drank considerably for comfort along with that. I stayed in Houston with NASA for about a year and a half after that, working on the very preliminary parts of the space shuttle program and kind of wandering around to the degree that I didn't have public appearances anymore, kind of wandering around with the freedom to direct and misdirect and waste some of my time while I was waiting for an assignment back to the Air Force. I was given an assignment to command the test pilot school at Edwards. I didn't think that was too good an assignment for somebody that had never been through school, the first time anyone's commanded it who's never been through it. And at a time when they get, you know, a space hero into govern the test pilot school at a time that they were de-emphasizing space at the test pilot school. I thought that what I could do while I was there was go through the school with the students and still administer and... But Jesus, I've been away from the service for 11 and a half years. 3.5 at MIT and 7.5 at in the NASA program. Not a lot of leadership or management in either of those situations. And I wanted to compare myself with what I ought to be able to do under those conditions and what my other classmates who'd been going to command and staff school and Air War College and all that. I was a setup for a crash, and I kind of crashed and was admitted to a psychiatric hospital with a cover-up of having a neck problem, which I had. My fingers were getting a little numb. While I was there, I made decisions to make big changes in my life. I was through competing in the Air Force, and this marriage that I had wasn't all that satisfactory. And here I was, with the red badge of courage, having sought help, and man, I was confident I was going to get it all together. So why not write a book about this glorious story where I'm going to marry this divorcee from New York? And that really sounded good at that time. Of course, most of the time I was in this hospital in San Antonio, on the weekends, every weekend I was off somewhere visiting, hunting with somebody or visiting somebody else and drinking considerably. I remember one time coming back into the hospital carrying a bottle of scotch in my navigator's kit bag. Now, when you're in a hospital trying to get yourself put together, and you know, people are paying a lot of attention to you, and you're sitting in the office with a guy who's got a picture of Freud on the wall with stars on his shoulder. Anyway, you just don't sneak in scotch into the hospital room while you're doing that. That's not quite normal behavior. Eventually, I wrote a book about my experiences called Return to Earth, which had to do with seeking psychiatric help for my fear and anxiety emotional problems. I remember a number of years after that, meeting a guy by the name of Abbott Mills somewhere, and he said, I read your book when it came out, and I said to someone, God, I wish somebody would tell this guy that he's purely an alcoholic. This was in 1973 that I wrote the book. And big deal. I mean, the emotionally wounded guy, what happened? The National Mental Health Association nominates him as National Chairman of the Year. And guess what he gets to do? He gets to go around the country making public appearances. Well, it was about me this time. And, you know, for a while, that was an interesting story to talk about. My recovery from depression. Except I didn't quite make all of the appearances. I'd gone through a separation at the time and had the freedom to be in my own place. And so there were times when I just wanted to stay home and drink. The last flight, let me see. While I was going through this business, I went through F training. And even before that, the shrink I was seeing put me in the VA. And in 1974 for 8 days. And he was the shrink who had retired as a colonel in the Air Force. He was also the same guy that was at Brooks Air Force Base when they ran our qualification physicals for the NASA astronaut program. He didn't know too much about alcoholism in those days, obviously. But he's learned a lot, and he's now certifying pilots for recovery from alcoholism for the FAA. And I'm sure he's learned a lot, and we've all learned a lot. But we didn't all get the kind of help that we needed back in those days. So in 74, in February, I guess this was actually 75, yeah. I was hospitalized for eight days in February, and I went to my first AA meeting, and I saw master sergeants there, and I saw other people who were sloshing around the hospital in bathrobes. It didn't make any difference that I happened to be sloshing around a bathrobe, too, but I was different. Anyway, I had no interest in that program at all. In April, I went to F training, and I drank considerably the night before, and peed in my pants considerably the first day of F training. Drank in between the two sessions, you're not supposed to do that. And yet I thought I received a good bit out of the training. Now, this is April, May. Sometime around July of 1975, I got an invitation to fly down to the Cape in John Denver's airplane with Werner Earhart to see the Apollo Soyuz flight. The only trouble is I had to tell him 2 days before that I couldn't make it because I was in the middle of a binge in my apartment. And it was a couple of weeks later that I went into my first recovery with my fiancé by the name of Beverly taking me to a place in Orange County that was called Beverly Manor. It later became known as Care Manor about a year later. I've got to say that my recollections of how I was functioning then are just sort of hazy. I didn't feel comfortable, and at the same time, I fit into that recovery program and played volleyball with the rest of them. And I thought, in a way, there was a sense of relief in going into that first program of recovery. Because I knew there was something wrong with me. Clearly, I'd been hospitalized for depression, anxiety. And having gone through several... And going into that first program of recovery. Because I knew there was something wrong with me. Clearly, I'd been hospitalized for depression, anxiety. And having gone through several releases or surrenders, I guess, made my first entrance into AA a bit... easier. Actually, it was a relief to think that all I got to do is don't drink what's in that bottle, and you know, it's a much nicer, cleaner thing to do to have wrong with you than this nebulous, cloudy thing of emotional depression. If I look back on it now, all that was going on was the alcoholic fear of losing what I had or not getting what I want. And those things are common regardless of what the particular sets of circumstances happen to be. My first 5 months in the program was really not in the program very well. And it was because of being a special person. I don't think there was a soul who would have succeeded in convincing me that 90 meetings in 90 days is the thing to do. It was very uneasy, and within about 6 or 7 months, I was back in the hospital for depression and given some medication prescribed by a physician who was in one of the recovery places. And it was an improper prescription for me at that time. Then I had a series of 20-30 day periods of sobriety. And all during this time, I've been introduced to the Navy program and visited there off and on just to see what it was like down in Long Beach. And I had met Dr. Kirk down there. About four or five months later, I was in recovery down there, and for 5 weeks I went through the Navy program. And there were guys who really didn't think I was going to make it.
my roommate called me up a couple of weeks ago and said, we just didn't think you were going to make it. And he called me from someplace in Florida, and he wasn't making it. My first sponsor really was not tough enough on me, or I wasn't listening. I had another sponsor, and I sort of picked him out because he had had a lot of experience in depression. And I was going through a good bit of it, and after 5 months, I had another six-pack or a pint or whatever it was. And this is now 2 years of recovery, and I'm just not seeing any progress. So some of the people that I knew thought that maybe I ought to go to therapy. So I turned myself into the Pacific Group, and I had a year of sobriety that was fearful. I can't say it was humiliating. It was a reduction of ego during that time, and it was a learning process of commitment. And it was all a very good period for me. I think Nancy would probably agree that we sort of wore each other out during that period. And I think he could see it coming that as my first year approached, I took my cake, and before I'd taken two cakes, I was drunk again. And there was a relationship going on during the time. And that had a lot to do with it. I was trying to rescue and save somebody and be detached, and you just can't do that. That was 8 days of continuous drinking with a friend of mine, and we went up into the desert, and he sort of went off and had to go to work and do his stuff, and it was miserable. And I came back, and I was rescued by the guy that was chasing his girlfriend around, and I really pecked at my wrist that night. A feeble effort. I obviously didn't want to accomplish very much. I called her up on the phone, and she wasn't there, so I went over and I broke in, and the neighbors called the cops, and they came and hauled me off for breaking in on him. Well, I was 3.5 years into this program. Not too much progress. A couple of weeks later, I had to appear in court to pay for the damaged door, and she didn't appear, but this guy, George, had been 13 stepping and all that. And that was degrading, and the anticipation of that got me drunk again. After that first 8 day period, I was in the hospital, miserable 8 days, trying to dry out and recover, and I didn't want to do that again, and I couldn't do it that time, and I was cold turkey, and that was October 25th, 5 years ago. I guess some of us have to go through what we need to go through. I was exposed to varieties of recovery people, recovery modes, hospitalization. After 5 or 6 months of searching around, I found the sponsor that I have today, and we meld together rather nicely. He's an engineer, he works for Hughes Helicopter, and we have a compatible views of spirituality. I found out early in my recovery that I felt it necessary for me to strip away the hypocrisy that I had grown up with. Even though things were very meaningful and it was important for me to, as a quiet astronaut participated in marching the parade for Martin Luther King, and it was meaningful for me to take communion on the moon. But somehow being an elder in the Presbyterian Church, even with Right Stuff John, didn't feel quite right to me. So I had to strip away that and rebuild. And I don't think I really have the time to go into my outlook on spirituality now, but it's a much more comfortable one. I can say that in the last 5 years, things have gradually gone up and down, and what has been characteristic of my recovery is that all the ups and downs are, they may last a little longer, but they're not as deep, they're not as threatening, and in a sense, I bounce off, and I participate in life in an exuberant, comfortable way, and I have the peace and happiness and the self-worth. I have a very unstructured life, and I wouldn't really miss out on anybody. You ought to get into a commitment where you need to be there. It makes things much easier. But the freedom of being able to choose what I want to get into, I've had glimpses of working in the last couple of years, and it is really beginning to work now. And I feel that what I'm involved in reflects what Joe Kirk told me in one of our debriefing sessions about a couple of years ago. He said, your contemporaries went out and they did their thing, and they're kind of living on whatever they did do and what they're doing now. You have the potential, because of what you've been through and what your way through and what you have experienced and changed and growth, to be a much more useful person, a much more comfortable person. There are a lot of tales that I'd like to have told that I've heard from the podium before about cucumbers changing into pickles and they never go back again. Things that I've heard my sponsor talk about that are very meaningful to me. And you heard them from somebody else. If you are going to meetings and things just aren't working, and yet after a while you stop going to meetings and you wander down and you sit in the bar for a while, and you're not sure what you're going to do, but the bartender comes up to you and says, hey, what's the matter? I thought you'd gone to AA. What are you doing in here? Wasn't AA work? He says, you've got to be honest with the bartender and hopefully honest with yourself. Because if you didn't work the steps and you didn't go to meetings, you got to say to him, you don't really know what AA works because you never tried. And I've tried in the past 5 years to work this program, and I can't say that I've got all A's for it, but I'm earning the benefits of it now, and there's no doubt, and I just know you got to believe me, because I do, that of all the great opportunities that have come along to me by talent, by birth, by upbringing, by being in the right place at the right time, none is going to produce more meaningful results in a human being than this program. This gradual growth and what I'm learning from sharing with people. And that's where it all is. I don't speak very often before groups, but I feel that maybe if I was a little bit more in my preliminary life leading up to this, it was to maybe show you, give you a glimpse of the person that would have been standing here 8 years ago. And the person that I know people have seen that remember me, what I was like 5 years ago, 3 years ago. And it's getting better and better, and I know it. And I tell you, there's nothing like knowing that you're getting weller. And I wish that the blessings that I've received from the fellow, and they're not all great. I mean, I've spent some periods where I don't want to participate in life, and I eventually get back out of it. And I lose a few things, but I regain those opportunities again. And I just hope that you can get as much out of this program as I have, and it's all really here. And it's in this book, and my sponsor gave me this cover. And it means a lot to me, and I just wanted to mention some things that are significant in there about the second edition, the story about the paradoxes. That touches on the essence of what I'm beginning to see, the spirituality that exists between reasoning human beings, just as much as if I drop this, it's going to splash on the floor, and there's a physical law. The laws that govern the relationship between us are embodied in the spirituality of this program. And those are as much a law and such a power that's mighty greater than me. And the refinements of that are the essence of what makes me know that this program works, and it keeps me coming back, and I hope you keep coming back to every one of you. Thank you.